It's Wednesday, March 9th, 2016, and this is KBIA's Views of the News. Our weekly roundtable on media behaviors comes to you from the Futures Lab studio at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Amy Simons, and here with me are my colleagues Mike McKean and Ernest Perry. On our program this week, a newspaper in Turkey raided and taken over by the government. We'll talk about what happened there. ESPN's Erin Andrews wins her case and is awarded $55 million by a jury in damages for that video that was taken of her getting out of a shower while she was in a Nashville hotel room. And less than a week until the Missouri presidential primaries, we'll take a look at the latest from the campaign trail. But let's start with the big headlines to come out of the True/False Film Festival this weekend, including a late add to the schedule. And when I say late, I mean it was literally and figuratively a late add. On Wednesday of last week, we found out that there would be a screening of Concerned Student 1950 at 11:30 Saturday night at the Missouri Theater. It's the work of three documentary journalism students here at the Murray Center for Documentary Journalism at the School of Journalism. So, Mike, you're able to stay up a whole lot later than I am. You were there Saturday night. Talk for a second about what the atmosphere was like, what it was like inside the Missouri Theater for this film.
Well, so first of all, the Missouri Theater, for folks who don't know, holds more than 1,000 people. There were quite a few folks who were there from a previous screening who stuck around. There was a huge line outside the Missouri Theater of students and others waiting to get inside. When David Wilson, who is one of the co-founders of True/False, introduced the film, he brought the three students up, Adam Dietrich, Varun Bajaj, and Kellen Marvin, brought them up and let them say a few words. They also brought up five of the student leaders from Concerned Student 1950. They talked a bit, and then they showed the movie. And, you know, to me, it was one of the few places where you really got to see a behind-the-scenes look of what the students actually went through prior to the events that really made the news. I mean, the second half of the documentary is mostly footage of things that we've seen before, like, you know, the president stepping down, like the Melissa Click video and other things. But the first half of that documentary was really compelling because these students had exclusive access with the group before all that came down. So you got to see sort of the anxiety and the anger that they were feeling about things that were happening directly to them. You got to tell what it was like on that night after the resignation when there was social media was abuzz with threats to black students on campus. And that was something that people really needed to see, and it added some context to the story.
So thanks to a screener that was provided for me and for Ernest by Stacey Wolfel, who is the director of the Murray Center for Documentary Journalism, we have had the opportunity to see it. It has not yet screened publicly. That's going to happen at a later time. Ernest, your reactions to what you saw there?
I agree with Mike. I mean, the behind the scenes presents a different narrative than what we've been discussing and what we've seen from the mainstream media and the national media about what happened in November. You get to see these students' interaction among themselves. You get to see their interaction with other constituencies on campus that you didn't get to see during that time period. And so you get to see a sort of different take than what's being presented right now about what happened.
One of the scenes in the film that stood out to me, which showed you just what level of access these three documentary journalism students had, was when the Concerned Student 1950 members came upon the graffiti at the Gaines Oldham Black Culture Center and seeing the word black spray painted out there and the shock and then the, hey, you have a light on your camera. Can you shine your light here? Can you let us see? Is this what really just happened? Is this what we just saw?
That was
a
really,
raw emotion that the access that these students were able to capture.
That was really an important scene. Another one for me, at least, was when the 1950 students came in to protest in front of a group of largely white women alumni at the Alumni Center.
Yeah, that was the one that was really striking to me.
And she's telling her, one of the students is telling her story about how she was called the N-word by a bunch of white people in a car outside the rec center. And she's saying, this is my university. I pay fees here. I pay for the rec center. And it just showed both her anger and her anxiety at having to go through all of that. And that's something I think we really needed to see.
Yeah, I think one of the other things you see is that there were other constituencies like the alumni women who were able to hear their message before everything happened with President Wolf. But then you also got to see, and this was what was really telling for me, that the scene of the football players coming out to the campsite and them saying that this started out with a few football players involved, and then it and then it grew to a larger number of football players. And I think that's part of the narrative that you didn't hear. I mean, what we heard was that it was the African American football players in mass standing with their coaches and this sort of thing, when in fact what it was a small group of football players who went to talk to other football players who then went to talk to the athletic administration about their concerns and feeling as if they had power. And they actually talked about the fact that that football players or athletes in general have power and they need to exert their power in certain instances. And that was the first time you actually heard it from them in that small group on the quad.
It was interesting, even in the part of the mini documentary where we had seen it before, aka the Melissa Click video, they showed a part of that. It was certainly a different viewing experience because it was probably the only place in the state of Missouri where you could get hundreds of people together who were actually applauding Melissa Click, who was in the audience at the time that portion of the film was shown. I think the other thing I'd just say about before we get past the involvement of our students, this was really unique because True Falls had never had a university student documentary in the festival. They had approved it just a few days before the opening night. They had support from some real powerhouse people, Laura Poitras, who made Citizen Four, and A.J. Schnock, who's a Mizzou grad who does documentaries. They're part of a project with The Intercept to support this kind of work. So they were behind them. That helped them get it over the finish line. And then, of course, we find out that Spike Lee was in town and
here for that as well. Here in part to do his work on a 30 for 30 documentary that he's doing for ESPN, specifically on the football team's involvement in this.
Right. I mean, he's here to sort of do a mini, one of their mini documentaries on that. I found it, you know, I had a little bit of a problem with the protests that occurred on Monday.
Those did feel a little bit staged
It felt staged, and even if it wasn't staged, there's just going to be this perception that it was staged. So I do have a problem with that. But one of the things that I did find interesting about the Concerned Students 1950 that I think relates to many of the things that we talked about in the show concerning that is you see a different take on the First Amendment issues in that piece that you haven't heard. The interaction between the Concerned Students and the media prior to the Melissa Click incident, and then what happens immediately afterwards when the students realize, well, wait a minute,
what the true intent was behind the safe space, as opposed to reacting to signs.
And the different definitions of safe space that the students had, as opposed to the media saying, well, but this is public property, we have a First Amendment right to cover it, and the students saying, but we also have a right not to participate in your coverage.
Which was another one of those moments when there's the Fox News Channel reporter who is interviewing a student and asking about that and kind of doing the well, you may want your safe space, but you're impeding on
and
my
I think
First
it,
to Amendment
me it
right
opens
too.
Up a larger conversation that I think we in the media need to have about when we talk about the First Amendment. It's not about us and our First Amendment rights, but the First Amendment rights of everyone that's out there, including the people we're interviewing. And I think sometimes that gets lost in the conversation because we in the media tend to focus on our First Amendment rights to cover a story more so than the broader First Amendment rights in those situations.
I agree with that. I think there's one other aspect of this that I found interesting with regard to the documentary and the reaction to it after the fact. And that's just the fact that we need all kinds of media sources to help us get a true picture, not just the documentary either, because it paints a narrow picture of those students from a particular point of view. And that's okay. But for example, we would not have known from watching the documentary what we found out on Monday, which was that Jonathan Butler, who went on the hunger strike, has had strained relations
himself.
Or separated from Concerned Student 1950, apparently over their tactics of insisting on these demands when the university is claiming at least to be trying to do something about race relations on campus.
Yeah, and I'd heard some of that during the conflict that was going on in November, that there was a strained relations between him and the students, and that they were trying to work through that at the time that all this was going on. But that part of the narrative also wasn't covered. So
and
there was a lot that we're going to
overshadowed by
right,
everything else.
There's going to be a lot that we find out as we move on about what was really taking place there. So, I mean, I think there are going to be other narratives that come out, but this was a really good one.
So we talked, Mike, and you mentioned and touched on how unprecedented the screening of this film was, the first student film. This was really a red letter weekend for our brand new Documentary Journalism Center. Not only this film showing, but again, Kate Plays Christine by Robert Greene, who's one of our faculty members who had that film debut about 5-6 weeks ago at Sundance, where it won an award. There were probably about 24 films that played at this film festival, and there's another one that's making headlines too. Film called Tickled. There has been a lawsuit filed in Boone County over this.
Yeah, so as I understand it, I didn't see the film myself, but David Ferrier is the filmmaker. He's from New Zealand. And he did this film about this company that apparently solicited young men, athletic men, and filmed them having taking part in competitive tickling contests. But and that just sounds weird.
Right, on the face of it, it sounds like.
But then the lawsuit you mentioned comes up because the other part of the film apparently was showing how this company and the guy behind it, David D'Amato, basically was threatening these students when they refused to take part in additional films, that he was sent to federal prison for a few months because he apparently tried to do denial of service takedowns of 3 different universities' networks and tried to blame it on or make it look like it was done by those students who refused to take part in the video. So he's filing for, you know, he's claiming defamation, and they had extra guards outside the theater. They were concerned that, you know, because he did show up. Mm-hmm. D'Amato and a couple other people from his company showed up.
I mean, they were saying that there was some private detectives that were hired by D'Amato, trying to get some audio of the film, and they were taken out by Columbia Police. This is strange to me, but it's one of those things where, and I'm pretty sure the documentary film producers as well as journalists face this all the time, where you have these threats of defamation, threats of lawsuits that come up all the time. So for it to happen in the middle of True False is pretty unusual.
Yeah. Well, I have an update for you and for our audience. If you'll remember, just about the time we were talking about safe spaces and the freedom of the press on public property here on our campus, there was a vote in the state Senate to remove reporters from the floor of that chamber. We talked about all of the reasons we were against it, chief among them the fact that it's the people's floor and that journalists should have access for transparency's sake. Well, the update here, it seems the plan is stalled. Senate leaders have delayed the construction of a new press mezzanine until the end of session this coming May because of the cost of construction. Meeting the initial March 29th deadline would have cost more than $40,000 in overtime costs, putting the final price tag for this mezzanine at about $127,000. Not worth it, state Senate leaders say, and they're going to fail to meet the deadline because of it. We're less than a week away, as we are right now here at this moment, from the Missouri presidential primaries. And over the weekend, I saw people out canvassing, and the commercial advertising for the presidential primary is really starting to pick up here in our market. And in some ways, it's starting to feel like that 3-ring circus is starting to close in on us. I mean, how can it feel like anything but a 3-ring circus when the entire weekend was overtaken by genitalia jokes?
You had that. You had the Republican establishment, basically
Mitt Romney with his speech.
Coming out basically saying that Donald Trump cannot be the nominee for the Republican Party. I mean, these apocalyptic terms from the establishment in some ways galvanized the Trump supporters to say, well, wait a minute, you know, we're following the rules, and now you want to change the rules because our candidate is leading in the delegate count. That's just not going to play out. So now you've got, it's just ramped up even higher.
And what you also had the past few days is that whatever Donald Trump wants to do on television, the cable television news networks will let him. So, you know, after the voting was completed in, or nearly completed in Michigan, he'd been declared the winner, in Mississippi. Trump calls this speech/news conference, mm-hmm. and all of the television networks carried more than an hour of Trump standing there, first of all, hawking his products, which aren't actually legitimate products that people can buy from stores anymore. And then he went into a long, you know, interview with the journalists, and that thing went on for an hour and was carried live. Carried live while, by the way, Hillary Clinton was giving a speech which was not carried by any of them. And so I just thought it just went to prove what we've been saying all along. Maybe the media didn't invent Donald Trump, but they sure as heck are subject to his ability to manipulate television, and they're willing participants in the manipulation.
Yeah, and here's the thing that I find troubling, is that now you're starting to get the stories about, I mean, from the other candidates, mm-hmm. from Cruz and others, basically saying that the media is complicit in Trump's numbers going up, and that now there's this sort of conspiracy that once he gets the nomination, then the media will begin to do hard stories on his finances, hard stories on his business dealings, and maybe some...
At which point there isn't another viable Republican candidate in the race.
Exactly, exactly. And sort of saying, well, now the liberal media is going to put out this information to derail Trump, and then we have Hillary
while
Clinton.
We talk about that other viable candidate, interestingly enough, this weekend, almost as quickly as it bubbled up, it then diffused rumors of Michael Bloomberg running for president as well, and what that might mean for Bloomberg News, for conflict of interest for his journalists there. And then Monday morning, Bloomberg publishes himself on Bloomberg View that he's not running because he did the math, and that he knows if he does, he can't win the Electoral College.
Yeah, and he doesn't want to do a third party because basically he's saying it never works out for the person running the third party as a third party candidate, and it gives someone, either the Republican or Democratic, clear shot into the presidency when that's not the way it's really supposed to work. So,
I mean, in some ways, you can say that he has less guts than Trump. He's always wants the coverage. Bloomberg wants people to notice him, but he won't pull the trigger, and Trump did. One other thing I'd say about this before we get off this topic.
Yeah.
Margaret Sullivan, who we talk about a lot, right, who is the ombudsperson or public editor for The New York Times, about to leave to go to The Washington Post. She's still doing her job in her last couple of months. She ran a really interesting piece this past week. And what she basically did is took a look at 14 days of New York Times coverage of the presidential campaign. And I think she found like 3/4 of the coverage was on the horse race and not on issues.
The types of stuff we're talking about here.
Process
now is,
stories.
Yeah.
And when she, I don't know if confronted is the word, when she took this to Dean Baquet, the executive editor, and other editors, of, oh, well, the horse race is really important. People want to read about the horse race. The horse race is in the most popular stories on our website.
The horse race is easy.
It is easy.
It is easy.
Now, the New York Times has plenty of reporters who can do stories about the substance of the issues facing them, and they will, and they have to a certain extent, but it's all been overwhelmed so far by process stories.
And those are the stories that, the process stories are the ones that are really, should be really important to voters, but if they're getting this other thing, it becomes this sort of game. Mm-hmm. And it's not what really should be driving the coverage of an important presidential race, especially one that is as fractured as it is, especially on the Republican side.
So one other thing I want to touch on quickly before we move on about this weekend in presidential primary news, if you will. We kind of used to have this bad inside joke when I worked at the Chicago Tribune that something wasn't really news until somebody at the Tribune experienced it themselves and decided it was news. Having the debate this weekend in Flint, Michigan, and seeing some of the photos that reporters from either national outlets or regional outlets had posted themselves once they realized they were in hotels with signs that said, don't drink the water, that were taped to water fountains. This became a story that hit home for a lot of national and regional journalists this weekend, that while we were covering Flint, it became personal.
Well, it became personal because they were there.
Realized, and they were thirsty.
And they were thirsty, and they realized, I can't drink the water. Yeah. I can't brush my teeth in my hotel using the water from the sink in my hotel room. Now, all of a sudden, they are part of the story, and they're going like, well, wait a minute. We really need to start questioning the presidential candidates and others about mm-hmm. what's going on. And at the same time, you had Congress basically being held hostage by one of the House members saying, I'm not going to let the bill to deal with Flint on a federal level go through because I don't think that we should be spending federal money on this. I mean, it's it's a story that is there, but I still think it's not getting the coverage because now the Michigan primary is over.
Everybody's moved on
to the next state. They move
on.
We're going
on to Flint becomes, Ohio and Florida
becomes the
and whatever.
Fifth story because the horse race continues.
I think that's true about the folks who are covering mm-hmm. the campaign. But I would also say there has been some outstanding journalism done by journalists in Michigan.
Absolutely.
And some
exactly.
on the national exactly. level exposing this problem, holding the politicians' feet to the fire. So I wouldn't paint it with too broad a brush.
Okay. Well, we'd be remiss if we didn't talk about the situation still developing in Turkey and the violent government seizure of a news organization there. Zaman was among the most popular newspapers with a circulation of more than 650,000 readers daily. Turkish courts ordered the takeover, claiming that the paper was closely linked to a movement, also linked to a U.S.-based cleric, that the Turkish government considers to be a terrorist group. Our government views this very differently.
Our government is concerned about, you know, press rights, what we would call First Amendment rights. But I think they're also concerned about the fact that Turkey is an ally in the fight against ISIS, so they can't go too far. I mean, what you have here is that the Turkish government is using the fact that they have the migrant crisis from Syria. They have ISIS fighters that are using their border as pretty much as a way to get in and out of the area. You have the EU trying to figure out what it wants to do about the migrant crisis. And you have NATO trying to figure out how it's going to fight that. So Turkey is being allowed, or the Turkish government is being allowed to move in a way that doesn't quite fit with what American government officials want to go.
Mm-hmm. I mean, and I'd agree that, I mean, these images of the Turkish government using water cannon and tear gas on people protesting the closing or the takeover of the newspaper, it was the number one most read paper in the country. You know, those are all bad, and we can all express our outrage, but because of all the geopolitical reasons that Ernest mentions, there's very little we can do about it. We have no leverage in this situation, really.
Right, right.
Okay, well, a Nashville jury awarded Erin Andrews a $55 million judgment in the lawsuit she filed against the man who filmed video of her getting out of the shower through a hotel room peephole in the Marriott Hotel, who allowed him to have the room next door to her.
I feel so ashamed. I'm so embarrassed.
It's a nightmare that doesn't stop.
Andrew's mother, Paula, described consoling her daughter.
It's not your fault. You're a victim. You've been assaulted. There was no calming her down.
Andrew's admitting that her life now is far from normal, saying she's filled with anxiety, grief, humiliation, and horror.
I'm so angry. This could have been stopped. The Nashville Marriott could have just called me. It could have stopped this.
So it's not likely that Erin Andrews is going to be able to collect the full amount of this judgment. The man who recorded that video doesn't have the funds to be able to pay it. It's more than likely that Marriott is going to end up appealing this, so she might take years before anything can go on here. But to me, the part that's the most newsworthy is how it has changed the environment, especially for female sports reporters, and how we're practicing safety when we're out in the field.
Well, I think not just female sports reporters, but female reporters
in general.
I mean, they're having to think about their own safety while trying to do their jobs. And as they go from place to place, I mean, we have a story on our links blog mm-hmm. from Sports Illustrated yeah. that in which they went out and talked to various women who are sports reporters and the things that they have to do to make sure that they're safe. And I remember early in my career when I was covering sports and you had the first women were out covering sports and what they had to go through just to get into locker rooms to be able to interview and
there.
To be able to cover those stories. And
I've
now
been there myself.
They're having to worry about their own personal safety.
That's right.
This is an issue that I think the companies that they work for themselves are going to really have to take a harder look at this.
Yeah, I think equally sort of depressing to me was the fact that the hotel chain tried to argue in court that she really hadn't suffered any lasting damage because,
right.
look, she's on Dancing with the Stars. She's on Fox Sports. She's making lots of money, so don't worry about it. And even more depressing to me was the fact that one of the people who was a spokesman or a representative for the hotel chain was caught in a restaurant with his friends during the trial watching the video.
Mm-hmm.
What does that say about our society that kind of behavior continues? It was just sad.
Well, I think to me what it says is that these companies need to be held accountable. I think the $55 million judgment does that. Of course, you'll never see that amount of money mm-hmm. actually being awarded. But I think the
At least received.
Yeah. But the verdict itself says that this is not going to be tolerated. And I'm pretty sure that the stockholders and those who run the company are going to be looking at their security procedures to make sure that this doesn't happen again, not just to her, but to others.
Well, I tried to write a clean segue into our next topic, and I just kept going back and hitting the delete key because there's no elegant way to write into this. And I'm not the only person who sees these two stories as related, but yet not related. It's about Hulk Hogan suing Gawker for publishing a video showing him having sex with his ex-best friend's ex-wife. The judge said very specifically that this case is legally very different than the Aaron Andrews case.
Well, it is, because you're talking about newsworthiness mm-hmm. and whether or not this is a newsworthy story. And I think Gawker has gotten itself into this position because they're saying that, well, this has been out there. He's talked about it. Others have talked about it. We just were the ones who decided to put it up on the air. And now we're being dragged into court over this when we shouldn't be.
Yeah, I mean, there are some similarities. They're both public figures, right? They were both taped without their permission. But the whole thing with Hulk Hogan is that he talked in public many times about his sex life. He's a celebrity, and that was part of why people talked about him. So you can argue that his sex life is newsworthy. But what's still at issue with the courts here is whether or not the tape shared on the internet, mm-hmm. you know, goes along with the protection that journalists have to talk about things like the sex life of celebrities. And I'm not so sure how that's going to come down.
Okay, well, while we're talking about sex tapes, why not talk about Hugh Hefner? He's actually doing something that's pretty cool. He stepped in and saved the student newspaper at his old high school. Steinmetz High School is on the northwest side of Chicago and has long battled with Chicago public school officials, both for funding and over the stories students wanted to cover. Last December, the principal fought the staff over a story on the school's new start time, creating the impression that the paper would close. But Hef wasn't having it. This is one of those cases where at the end of the day, old school journalists are going to have student journalists back.
And I don't know that absent of the principal trying to censor the paper that it would have really been that big a deal whether they were print or mm-hmm. online only. But good for Hefner to step up and put the money forward to keep the print publication going, and also, by implication, telling the school principal, you can't do this to the paper.
One of the anecdotes that kind of gave me a good chuckle was that while the students appreciated his support, not all of them believe in what it is and what he does. And when he came to visit the school, they also had a piece in the paper about pornography objectifying women. And
Good for them.
Okay, well, that music means we're pretty much out of time for today. I'd like to thank you for spending the last half hour with us. You can read more about the topics that we talked about today on our links blog. That's under the programs tab on kbia.org. Like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Our handle is @viewsonkbia. These are all great ways to watch and listen to our program again, to leave us comments, questions, see what we'll be talking about next time, and more. Our thanks to RJI's Travis McMillan for directing today's show. Maya Jackson is our technical director. Pat Akers handled the audio for us today, and Si Chen is our associate producer. I'm Amy Simons. We're going to be off next week, but we'll be back with you March 23rd for another edition of Views of the News.